Welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today I'm delighted to bring an interview with the very successful indie author, Michael R. Miller. Michael has recently released his latest book called Defiant, and over the years he's achieved tremendous success both with audiobooks and ebooks and paperbacks, and he's just been doing all this himself with the team that he put together. It's a fantastic conversation, and if you're someone who wants to go down the indie route too, then you're going to learn an awful lot. Before we get to it though, just a quick reminder to subscribe or follow the show just so you don't miss any future episodes. And the next episode that we've got coming up is an interesting one. It's Halloween, obviously, the end of the month. And with this episode coming out on the 28th, we're going to do a Halloween special and going to take a look all at monsters. And this is something I've been wanting to do for a long time, but I needed to find the right person to talk to about it. And I was lucky to find that person. And that's coming up on the 28th. It's also going to be the last episode of the series. We'll be taking a short break till the new year. But then we'll be back and we've got lots of interesting things in the pipeline. So don't worry. There's plenty to listen to anyway. I was looking back the other day and didn't really appreciate how many episodes we've actually done. So might be on for a record, the longest second season ever. If you'd like more than just what you hear on this podcast, then check out our writing community. We meet on Discord and it's a fantastic place to join weekly, bi-weekly writing groups, get help with beta reads, discuss ideas, and one feature we've recently launched is first line critique and first paragraph critique. So if you're struggling with that opening line, it's such an important one. I've been working for about a week solidly on the opening line of something I'm working on at the minute. I understand the difficulty, and getting that feedback is really, really helpful. So if you want help with your opening lines and opening paragraphs, then check out the link in the description. You can also find a link to our Patreon page if you want to get the likes of writing classes, books, guides, all with a focus on writing fantasy. Then check out Patreon. There's loads of stuff there and there's tiers for everybody. Now it's time to get on with the show, and I'm delighted to introduce Michael R. Miller. I'm delighted to be joined by Michael R. Miller, author of the Songs of Chaos series. Michael, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, good, Richie. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks very much for joining me. I know it's been an exciting and busy time for you at the minute with a new book out, Defiant. Do you want to tell us a bit about it?
Oh, yeah, sure. So Defiant is book three in my Songs of Chaos series. This series is a kind of big Dragon Rider epic, very much kind of with its initial inspirations coming from the likes of Eragon. But then I'm trying to put my own spin on things with hard magic systems, taking inspiration from progression fantasy, in particular Will White's Cradle series, amongst others, and trying to sort of blend up that kind of cultivation progression fantasy with a big old Dragon Rider epic, which is in theory ageless and can be enjoyed by sort of everyone. That's what I'm going for. And the launch of book three has gone tremendously well. As I was just saying to you, like, audio is my bread and butter these days, but the audiobooks really just blew up even beyond my wildest expectations. So I'm still a bit stunned still. It's still in the same month, so I'm still sort of keeping an eye on it, and it's just like, it's been incredible. So I'm very happy with how things are going right now.
Oh, nice. Well, congratulations. And it's been a really widely read book as well, hasn't it? Have you sold over 300,000 copies of the series?
So I've sold over 300,000 copies across my career. It's something like 309,000 something at this point. Defiant definitely blew over the edge, and like the launch of that book really pushed over that 300,000 mark.
Yeah.
Songs of Chaos itself has now sold something like 140,000 copies, and that's, you know, just the two books plus the third one's just come out. My previous trilogy, The Dragon's Blade, has sold about 155,000-160,000 copies, but Songs will very quickly blow past that, and there's going to be two more books and songs, so it should keep growing. If one book on its own has sold 300,000, that would be another level. Maybe one day, but for now, I'm pretty happy just to have hit that milestone, and yeah, keep my eye on the next one, see how far we can go.
Definitely, it's an incredible feat, and anyone who's been involved in writing will know how difficult it is to sell books. So It's really hats off to you. Congratulations. Hope it all goes
Thanks,
well for
man.
the next one as well. Exciting
Yeah,
stuff.
well, hopefully, you're on a bit of a roll. It would be a shame to to end it at some point, but hopefully it can keep going. Yeah,
Yeah, well, I'll put the
because
links
I can't
to
work a day job. I'm screwed. It's like it's this or
the
nothing, really.
Well, that's an interesting sort of segue. So next question is, how does it all begin? Where did you start with your writing, and how did you sort of end up where you are today?
Sure. So, apologies to anyone that's heard me waffle on about this before, but I started writing what became the first book of the Dragon's Blade. I started writing that seriously when I was about 21. That was the idea that had been in my head since I was, 9 or 10. Like most people, a lot of people have that kind of one idea. I moved to London after university. I did a history degree, so naturally, you don't know what you're going to do with that. And I kind of foolishly thought, oh, I'll go and do a law conversion course because why not? It's either that or become a teacher, right? So this course is called the GDL, where they take the full 3 year law degree in England and they smush it into 1 year. So it's really quite intense.
Yeah, I
So I
have a
kind of
law
came down.
degree as well, so yeah, I know the pain of
Oh,
that.
you did the, oh my God. So you did the full one, like the
Yeah,
full 3 years.
3 years, and that was
Yeah,
enough for
so
me.
and I take the 3 years and I mash it into 1 year. Oh my God. It was intense. So I was doing that. So I moved down to London. Knew no one. Started this course, which is super intensive. Just and then a few other things in the personal life weren't going brilliantly at this time. So 6 months, halfway through the course, I just had like I don't know a quarter life crisis or something. As I thought, I don't want to do this. It's the one time I've really found it. I found it hard to get up in the morning, but. For some reason, I decided to turn back to that book idea, and I just started writing it, despite the fact that I had this overwhelming amount of coursework to do. I just sort of had to write it, and so I wrote that book whilst I was doing the course, and basically had absolutely no life for the whole time. But I got the book done, and it was looking back, that first book, that version that first went out was a little rough, and of course it's going to be rough because I was 22 when I started it, 23 when I finished it. I released it late in 2015, and the reason I went the indie route was because I knew it would come out then. So I knew it would come out if I did it. Because if I had to go through the whole process of trying to get it traditionally published, odds are it wasn't going to happen. And I needed that drive of knowing this will happen to kind of get me through writing it and get me through that time in my life, which was a little bit sucky, put it mildly. But from there, I obviously started writing the second one and just sort of tried to find my feet. I worked some retail jobs, and then eventually I got into Bloomsbury Publishing. That's the Harry Potter publisher in
Nice.
London, for those that don't know. And I was just there essentially a kind of not quite, it was like a kind of entry role stuff, doing some data management work in the marketing department. So it wasn't anything too crazy, but it got me some insight because I was sitting in the marketing department there, or at least a portion of it. So I was kind of seeing what was happening. And it was around the end of that contract, which was initially 7 or 8 months, that the second, the then I had two books out, and at that point they started to pick up enough that I decided to try and just jump over. And I was wrapping up the third book, and I just decided to just throw in with it and try and capitalize on the little bit of momentum that was building and really go for it. It was also at that time that I'd met Taryn Maffra and Brooke Afton, who the three of us started a publisher together called Portal Books, which focuses on, but focused initially on the RPG. They now focus mainly on progression, fantasy, cultivation, the sort of stuff that Ascendant is adjacent to. So I couldn't do three things, so I decided to kind of come out of work, which was definitely a risk. I mean, a few months of things working doesn't necessarily mean it's going to keep working, but the third book came out, that helped. And then I kind of had the big break late in 2018 when I put the initial Dragon's Blade trilogy into one box set, an ebook box set, and that really took off. Now, I think the key thing that I did at that point was I went back and I didn't rewrite it from scratch, but I heavily rewrote and edited the first book with the benefit of hindsight of having finished the series, and that experience meant I could go back and improve it. So it was the same story, but better, right? And I mean, I could go back now and do the same thing and it would become better, but it's not really worth it. But you're always getting better, hopefully. So it was a really smart decision, because I think when the box set then did go out, it was in the best shape. Like I didn't just sort of take it for granted that first book was good enough. So it was definitely worth the time. And around this time, 2018 was the heyday of ebook box sets. Like, so the strategy was you would put your trilogy or your whatever series out, the whole thing for just 99 cents, 99p. Yeah. And you lost lead sales so that you can get Kindle Unlimited downloads and people will read the whole thing. So on Kindle Unlimited, if someone downloads the book, you get paid money for every page of the book that they read. And so if someone is downloading a free book box set, it's like 450,000 words long in total. That's a lot of pages.
Yeah.
So even if there's a bunch of people buying it in 99 cents, if you get enough people who just grab it for free, in quotes, on Kindle Unlimited, and they read the whole thing, you're earning as much money or more sometimes as if they just bought each book. So that was the strategy. And it was working really well in 2018 for a lot of people. And for whatever reason, mine just seemed to work. It just seemed to work super well. Like that box, it just went crazy. Like it went to number 90 in all of Amazon, which was nonsense. Oh, like, yeah, like I know it was like number one. Everyone was amazing. And then even though it started to come down, once it kind of peaked, I was like, okay, it can't get any higher than 90. I switched up the price back to $2.99 to try and strike with it. And so, and then it came down gradually as these things do. But it clung on there tooth and nail. So like it just came down really, 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 really slowly. And all through that time when it was ranking very high, I was getting sales still, but I was also getting lots of KU reads. It was a big break moment, and it was like, oh no, this is work. I can absolutely be full time here because this is blowing the barn doors off compared to what's happening before. And then in early 2019, I released a standalone lit RPG story called Battle Spire, which did very well. Burned bright as the sun for about 2 months and then fell away. That's kind of how those books work. But that was amazing just because it was such a fun book to write, and the fact that it also did well just kind of kept that momentum going. It was like, okay, this is not a fluke now. Like I can really do this. This is my job. And then I started writing what became Ascendant. It was meant to be smaller. It turned out a lot bigger. And I'm still writing that series to this day. I've been working on Ascendant since Songs of Chaos since 2019 and still going. So
nice.
It's got a while yet to go. But
there you go.
But since that first break, everything's just kind of kept building and getting bigger and better. It might not have. I mean, Ascendant being the first book in a new series could have tanked. And if it had, that would have reset things. But thankfully, it didn't. And things have kept going up. So, yeah, it's been lucky, I guess. Been lucky to get that break when I did it.
Yeah.
And it's an unusual way to go through. It's an unusual way to navigate it. But yeah, and then in 2020, the real magic that happened in 2020 for me, I know COVID wasn't very magical, but for some reason, my audiobooks really took off at that point.
Yeah.
And that takeoff of audio has been really, really big. It meant that I didn't just, most, a lot of people tend to have like ebooks that work for them. And they might have audio working for them, but they tend to have audio through a publisher.
Yeah.
Even indies, there's lots of studios that people can go to. I'd always done my own audio. Like, you know, self-production. So like I hire a narrator and stuff, but I keep the rights and therefore keep the higher cut.
Yeah.
And when that took off, it was like, oh, now there's two formats working like in this, you know, so it was just, again, another big transformative moment. So that kind of takes us up. To
nice. It's an amazing journey. And like you say, you took the chance because that's what you wanted to do. And it's really sort of endearing to hear that it all worked out and that you sort of, just went for it, you know what I mean? You've got to try, haven't you?
I think you've got to try. I mean, there's that worry that like if someone was to ask me when should I take the leap, I don't want to tell them when because I don't want to be responsible in case it doesn't work. But you've got to know yourself when there's a chance to try and go for it, because you know everyone that's writing and has the day job still, and I can remember it's just you end up, you're sort of killing yourself. You're working two things very hard. You can only do that for so long in some ways, I think, if you're really going at it full tilt. So there's a time to try and put all as much of that energy into the one thing. Not so much that you can write more, but just that you can balance it a bit, you know, so you can actually get a life back and get to the gym more again and stuff like that and make it work, but make a whole life out of it rather than trying to sort of desperately sort of get squeezed out on the sides. Everyone's probably got that critical point in their career, but it's going to be different for everyone and everyone's going to have to weigh that up. But You've got to dive in at some point.
You do, yeah. It's a great model that it sounds like you've created as well, and a sort of reliable one that has allowed you to grow a sort of sustainable business, really, hasn't it? Like you can keep growing and growing and growing. So could you tell us how you sort of approached the business side of the writing?
Oh, I wish I... No, I don't know if there's much more to say. I mean, I really just tried to make the books as good as I can possibly make them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Songs of Chaos being a big old Dragon Rider epic is clearly... It has its audience. It has a clear audience that I can talk to about it.
Yeah.
It's got a little bit of a built-in. There's some people that just really love those kinds of books. So if you present something to them that is very well packaged and has a great blurb and a great title and just sort of sounds like it's really good and it's well put together,
yeah,
they'll give it a go. And then if the book is really good, then they'll talk about it and recommend it. And that's the kind of critical part. So it definitely helps to, and I like those kinds of stories. I like trying to take those really big mythological epic or sort of the things that can get your heart beating kind of inspire you a little bit.
Yeah.
And just try to find it, but try to find those intersections where I can put in the stuff that I like into it. So like, yeah, there's a few darker, there are some darker elements, there are some darker characters, etc. But it isn't all light and fluffy and rainbows, and far from it, especially as the series goes on. But just trying to find that intersection of like, I am happy, I feel a lot of satisfaction in writing these stories. It also happens to have a fairly good commercial track that you can tap into, which is helpful if you're inclined to go that route, you know.
Yeah.
I think if you're writing something a bit more esoteric, that's great. You just got to know that you've got to be aware that's going to be a little bit harder to get off the ground and you approach it differently.
So move over towards the writing. So what kind of approach do you take? Do you like to focus on your characters, or like you say, the sort of exploring that expansive world? Is that something?
No, characters always first. I mean, it's always a bit of a yin yang sort of thing, but I always start with kind of like, you know, with songs that started with the main characters, the main two, Holt and Ash, Ash being the blind dragon, Holt being the cook's apprentice, and just what would their journey be? What's the, you know, following for that first book, it's very much a kind of study in the hero's journey arc, and then the book two and book three can go off in their own directions. But I start with the characters and I'm like, okay, so in this book, what are the arcs that I need to take them on? Where am I trying to get them to, and what, you know, what they're going to go through first? If I don't have that, then everything else doesn't really matter. Like sometimes there's a cool plot idea that pops up, but I won't let it get onto the outline unless I can be like, okay, the cool plot element is able to functionally tie into the character's arc in this way. You know, like why is this working? Always has to be the character arcs for me. I like to see growth in the characters. I like to see characters that do change. Typically my characters don't remain static, you know, like you can write some great characters who are static, trying to think like Superman, obviously being the classic one, like doesn't change. It's just the same, that kind of episodic thing where the character doesn't change, which is fine. Mine tend to change quite drastically. So like where Holt and Ash begin in book one, by the time you get to the end of book three, they feel like different people. And I think into four, they'll feel like very different people, which is why I like to see that kind of, that the subtle changes where you see people shifting around, but they still are acting consistently like themselves. They're not, it's not a complete 180, you know?
Yeah.
It's a delicate balance, but that's what I like.
Definitely, yeah. And how have you found the most effective way of achieving that in your writing? Like that character growth?
Oh, I don't know. Just do it.
Yeah.
how do you put that down?
It's like having a connection with the character, isn't it? So you sort of know how they're going to respond to a sort of a conflicting moments in the story.
Yeah, I guess you have to put them into, they'll change through the conflict, but they'll also, you have to put them into situations where like whatever preconceived notions of right and wrong, or the world, or whether you have to challenge their preconceptions of things. And when they hit up against that, they might not radically change. They might not completely disperse their ideas, but if they take it on board, the next time they're presented with a similar situation, they'll act differently because they picked up some experience from before. And I think if you do that truthfully enough, the character will see that they're changing, but you don't have to like slap people in the face of it. You know, you don't have to kind of write that in. He had changed his mind. You can just show that they're changing how they interact just because of those experiences they've run into. You know, I mean, a big one for Houghton, beginning with Sin. I mean, it's definitely a coming of age story through books 1, 2, 3. And at the end of book 3, the kind of coming of age thing is very much wrapped for them, which I'm excited by because I think it'll be really cool going into 4 a bit more hardened. But Holt begins thinking that being a dragon rider is that the best thing ever. It would be so amazing because you can do whatever you want. You're free. You've got a dragon. You've got magic. Yeah. That's amazing. He's just cleaning pots in the kitchens all day long, getting blisters on his hands, you know, and wrinkly fingers. He just thinks being a rider would be the best thing ever. He isn't really thinking about the horrors of it because they have to fight these, you know, this like scourge zombie bug army sort of stuff. That's kind of like the big existential threat that they fight. He doesn't think about what they have to do in terms of all the horrible fighting. He doesn't think about all the really hard decisions they have to make about who lives and who dies.
Yeah.
If they're put in that position where who do they save and who do they not save? All the responsibility that comes with it. By the end of that book, he's had a taste of it and he's like, oh, yeah, it's not so rosy.
Yeah.
Right, but you have to put him through the ringer a little bit. So he's still kind of, he's still himself, but he's kind of like, oh, my, what I thought the world was like is not quite like that.
Yeah.
I think that's how you make them change. You have to present them with things like that, go against their biases.
A bit like you and your GDL. Yeah.
Well, I went into that. I didn't really. That was me zombie walking into something without really thinking about it. Slightly different, but yeah.
It's a young age to try and work out what the hell you want to do with the rest of your life. It's incredible the pressure on people's shoulders. Like I was a lawyer for a few years and then decided I didn't like it. So it's just you've got to try things, haven't you? And it's only when you learn what you don't like that you force yourself to discover what you do actually like. So there's a good, we always get a good amount of questions on world building. So
okay,
always ask writers how they approach creating worlds and how to avoid things like info dumps. You got any tips for us?
I mainly avoid info dumps by not actually knowing a huge amount about the world myself. So I'm not a massive world builder.
Yeah.
Like I said, the stories are there really to service the characters. And I world build as much as I need to and not really too much more because I think I would dump in stuff if I knew too much.
Yeah.
Because there is a definite, if you know a lot, it's definitely a skill to be like, pare it back. I'm actually working on the polishing up a novella of the series right now that was just a sort of freebie on the mailing list, but it was a little rush. But now that I've written more of the books in the series, I'm now having to be like, oh, I need to watch how much I put into this, and you know what I mean? So I before writing, when it comes to like the outlining stage, where I know there's going to be really important elements, I will build those out a little bit before, but let everything else just kind of be, and I'm quite happy to kind of sprinkle stuff in as I go, so long as it's kind of just hinting at stuff that, you know, I'm not trying to lock myself in so I would end up contradicting myself.
Yeah,
but just kind of do that hint thing where you're hinting to the iceberg, but the iceberg isn't really there. But the stuff that I know is going to be important, I will build out, and then I give that quite a lot of depth. And so it's kind of like the Robin Hood quote, where like if you absolutely nail all the horse lore, then we'll believe you when you tell me about the dragons, right? So if you get a few things done very well, people will kind of believe that the rest of it is that well done, even if it isn't.
Yeah,
that's what helps create that illusion. So
nice.
Like for songs, I knew that the sort of cooking magic system would be quite important. So I kind of built that out before, you know, the different, I knew that the magic system was going to be very important. So I developed that quite thoroughly beforehand. And that's a big part of the book. But stuff about like what other kingdoms are in the world, what other nations are in the world, what other cultures in the world. For book one, that really wasn't important. So they just got some names.
Yeah,
and that was about it, and it was only really for book 2 that I had to think about them a bit more, and then book 3 think of them about them even more, and now that's all established. But I just did it as I went, as I needed it to. I wasn't sitting there prior to book 1 thinking of the nations that are like on the other side of the world that we don't meet until book four. It's just not relevant. So I didn't burden myself with knowing that stuff. So I couldn't possibly have put it in. So I couldn't possibly have info dumped it in because I didn't know.
Nice.
So yeah, I guess it's like, it's the, faking the iceberg, right? Or whatever. You're trying to show the tip of the iceberg. There isn't really an iceberg under the surface at all. There's as much as I need.
It's a really
convince
good
you that there's an iceberg.
Because we've only got so much time and writing takes up a lot of it, and then having to build a world in great depth on top of that is too much. So just build what you need, isn't it? Get on with the writing.
Well, but some people love world building. That's great. I mean, you got to do it the way that you find passionate about it. But if I just sit there and think about, oh, what kind of cool world building stuff, it doesn't really come to me. I kind of need to know what the story, I need to kind of know what the story purpose is. And that comes back to the characters. So like just making up this nation in the world and making up some cultural stuff, some language stuff, some history. If the character isn't going there, it's not relevant. My brain just doesn't like to just make stuff up like that. I just sort of don't get tons of pleasure out of just world building for the sake of world building. But some people do, and that's great. So you just have to, if you're like that, you just have to be very aware not to just info dump more than, you know, the excess. But if you're like me, the trick is there's not a lot to info dump, so you get away. the trick is really you've got to make sure that what you are putting in is very well thought out, because I think then people will trust that you know more than you actually do.
Nice. Fantastic bit of advice. What challenges have you faced with your writing? Any aspect of your career, really? What have you done to sort of overcome it and break down the walls?
If we're talking about actual like craft, I think in Defiant was pretty hard because as you say, Dave, it's all this stuff that I'd hinted at before that I had to then make up. And in particular, like the way that the power system works, there was kind of like this very strict hierarchy of powerful characters. And by book three, it was kind of like I couldn't keep putting off these characters not being involved in what was going on. Yes. And there's quite a lot of them. So I had to deal with all these people and dragons. And there was, you know, eight of them who kind of have to be acknowledged, and they have to, you have to know what they're doing and why. And so it was like I had suddenly eight, and it all needs to work into the story, because I can't just ignore these people anymore.
Yeah.
It won't be true. So that was very difficult, because it just sort of blew up the size of the cast and the amount of stuff I had to think about. And in the end, I was considering adding just one additional POV for this book, which was like one of the head of the Dragon Rider Order. And he has kind of four colleagues that are at his level, kind of equals, but he's like the first amongst equals. And I realized that I kind of had to show at least the POVs of two of the others, because a lot was going to be, I had what they were doing mapped out, but it was all kind of off screen to the leader. And it just wasn't going to work. It just wasn't going to work. Like there'd been a lot of chapters of him being worried about what they're doing. And then the reader would be like, well, what are they doing? And yeah, you know, if you want to make it a mystery, that's fine. But they would just sort of pop back in at the very end of the book, and it would just be really weird and rushed. So I felt like, no, I've got to show what they are doing, those two. So now I've added in three new POVs to the story, which is a lot of POVs to add in. I already had four, and I got seven. But the way I decided to get around that initially was just kind of, I would cluster, because those three new POVs were so interlinked, generally speaking, when they had chapters, each of them, it was like a chapter where I showed all three of them in kind of very short scenes back to back. So I'd show one of them, flip to the other one, flip to the other one. So a standard chapter would have three POVs in it rather than just the one, and they would be shorter scenes. And they would be sort of scattered, they were scattered through the book a bit, sort of semi-infrequently.
Nice.
And I felt that worked best rather than having these big, rather than trying to, because the gaps between the different POVs are already getting quite long. I couldn't just add in these big chunky things. I thought I'll kind of mush them into segments and flip more. And that worked. I felt that worked. I mean, some people won't like it. Some people don't like it when you add POVs in. There's always a small percentage that just hate when new POVs come into the story, you know, in book three or four of a big series. But I had to show these guys, I had to know what they were doing. And I think there's a lot of elements that really benefit from seeing it, especially in a reread.
Definitely.
But yeah, I was quite happy with that solution. Like, rather than, yeah, just be happy to write shorter scenes, flip over, flip back, kind of cutting a lot more as if it was a movie in some ways, like cutting away, being more confident just to cut away when the scene ends, rather than trying to cumbersomely extend it to make a full chapter, sort of in quotes, just because you feel like you need a whole POV chapter. Just go. Just cut, go to the next person, cut again, go to the next person. Keep the long chapters for your main guys, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's how I felt I overcame that one. And that whole book was so massive. Like, it took me ages. It was 300,000 words, which I managed to cut down to 250,000 words.
Nice.
So there was a lot of fat in it. Well, it was 50,000 words of just sheer fat, because if I read it now, I don't think anything's missing. So there was just a lot of fat there. It's a very difficult book. I'm hoping the fourth one is not as difficult, because spoilers, some of those POVs start dying, so it makes my life easier. I can start removing them from the story. Desperation there, but yeah, I think I've become a bit more comfortable now with the idea of just doing a scene,
yeah,
and just cut there and then go somewhere else. And some people may find it choppier, but I think it's going to help flow a little easier, because you know those, because you write as well, Richie, right? Those transition scenes, those scenes where you have to stitch two scenes together, can be really hard, really clunky and cumbersome, right? I mean, you've naturally come to a nice stop, but you feel like you have to keep going with this chapter somehow. And you just have these paragraphs of kind of waffle where you're getting them out, in and out of a room or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, I think we can do away with
just,
that.
Just end it.
Just do away with it. Just end it. It's just this arbitrary that we have to have these big blocky chapters that are kind of like, almost like reminiscent of the 90s style of Wheel of Time and Game of Thrones and everything, where each chapter was just one big block and you never flipped ever.
Yeah.
But I don't see why that needs to be the case. I think we can flip more.
It could be more like cinematic. A bit of a collection of scenes, really, isn't it? So you just jump from scene to scene and in between. Doesn't really matter, does it? It's not that important.
No, I mean, there's a limit, right? You only do it every 2 seconds. It would be annoying, but, you know, I think being willing to, if you've got multiple POVs, I think being willing to intercut between them more often, I think is interesting.
It can add to the suspense.
Famous last words.
When you've got different POVs as well, and especially when they're all following different storylines, then it can add to the suspense and the tension, because you can just drop off there, pick up on another one, leave that character in a bit of a cliffhanger, move on to another one, leave them in a bit of a cliffhanger, back to the other. And you're just constantly...
Yeah, well, it's kind of like how a movie would do it. The movie would end with a kind of a, oh, where is she looking off? And then it would cut over to where is she is, and you see her, and you, rather than if it's all... I mean, it obviously depends on how you're writing the story, but I, you know, multiple POV, big book like this, I'm quite happy to think, yeah, I'm going to make it like a big epic movie. We're going to cut away, we're going to show stuff. We're going to do the whole thing. We're going to have one-off guest POVs occasionally. We're going to do the whole thing, because if I just stick to one pair of eyes the whole time. There are some readers that want me just to stick to Holt the entire time, which is fine. But there's no way he can see the whole story.
Yeah.
So you'd have to jump through weird hoops. It's a bit like in Harry Potter, where like Harry, people just turn up and tell Harry information sometimes. You're like, this is just to give Harry this information because he has not seen the thing. And it's like, sometimes you're like, you wouldn't just tell the character that, but fair enough. So, yeah.
Yeah. I love POVs.
Well, that was the
I
challenge for the
fine. I just scatter them in, especially
you just go for it.
First novel, I wanted to show that the main antagonist was an evil, sadistic bastard, because a few chapters before that I introduced his POV, and he's a bit likable. So I just wanted to show everyone that he's actually a bit of a bastard. So I introduced just this young sort of seaman it's like a battle involving these sea forts, and he's one of the defenders, and it's just from his perspective as these sort of like mercilessly like kill everybody, and he's there at the very end, and you see him. Yeah, it's fun. It's good. It just breaks it up. When you're writing a novel that long as well, you can't just write it from the same person's point of view. You just get a bit bored. Even the reading needs a bit.
I think so. Well, again, it all depends on who you are, but I naturally find, because I focus so tightly on these character arcs, I find that actually, I mean, short of maybe the absolute main characters, who tend to have more words just because they overlap with everyone else. They usually meet everyone else at some point so that they naturally just have more screen time that way. But I tend to find that these character arcs in a book will be, you know, 40 to 50K, maybe a little longer, maybe 60K each max, because any more than that, it might not feel very well paced, especially if you've got to do four POVs. And then you do four POVs at 60K, roughly speaking, then you're at 240 already in terms of word count, which is a huge word count. So
yeah,
I don't know if I could sit with just one character for 200,000 words. I don't know. I feel like I wouldn't. I feel like I wouldn't, because I feel like I would. I'd be trying to keep the arc quite tight.
It'd be tough. Let's just say that it'd be tough.
There's Name of the Wind fans out there saying you can write one character.
Nice. So we were actually met a few years ago, didn't we, at FantasyCon, and we were on a panel about book marketing, and I was really enjoying what you were saying. That's back right. Then. And before we finished, I just wanted to ask you about marketing, because again, we get a lot of questions about it. People are just desperate to find readers. And that is the biggest challenge, how to get their book before readers. So how have you managed to do it over the years? Have you got any sort of tips to share?
Well, so much of all of this depends on whether you're a trad or indie and then your genre. So I can only speak for being an indie epic fantasy author.
Yeah.
Which is a very peculiar niche. A lot, I would say, if you're writing epic fantasy or high fantasy, that kind of adjacent stuff, at the moment, I don't really rate the digital ads very well. I don't think they work very well anymore, if they ever did. If you're a crime writer, a romance writer, etc., Facebook, these things are still brilliant because the market's just so much bigger, so many more readers. I think they've got a different style of picking up books, those kind of readers, whereas I feel more of the epic fantasy crowd are much harder to entice. It can be hard to get them to give you a chance, but if you get them to give you a chance and they like you, then they're typically more loyal than a crime thriller reader who's reading through tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of stuff.
Yeah.
So it can be definitely a case of pushing a boulder up a hill a little bit, but I think once you get a bit of momentum in epic fantasy, it rolls a little more smoothly, but you know, everyone's mileage is going to vary there. So I don't hugely recommend blowing money into Facebook ads. I mean, I really think they're completely screwed. I've used all kinds of affiliate tracking on them in the past, and the data is really disturbingly bad. So I would, you know, you can try, but I wouldn't. Yeah. I wouldn't. If anyone's saying to you spend thousands on Facebook, I'd be like, well, test it out if you like, but I don't think it works very well. I think Amazon ads do work, but they don't really scale. So you usually find some kind of sweet spot and you kind of keep it on as like life support if you want to.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, if Amazon just let me scale it, like, you know, if your budget's $100 and it's working well, I would just go, all right, $200, which is double that and double the results. No. Once if you try to like scale it, it just falls over.
Yeah.
for some reason, it's very linked to the actual algorithm. So like, and books on Amazon ads tend to only really, I've noticed that they tend to only really work well if the book itself is already quite popular and quite hot.
Yeah.
So it's like the algorithm is, they're kind of linked in a little bit, which is unfortunate because, you know, some folks who are if their book's struggling a little, they go into Amazon ads and they can't get it to go at all. And I think that's partly because the system goes, well, I'm not going to push a book that isn't selling.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't push it, and then it becomes self-fulfilling, of course. But I do think that's part of the problem. Yeah. But even if you can get it to work, it doesn't scale super well. So you can get it to work to a point, and then that can be part of your background activity if you want it to be, and that's fine. So, I mean, at the moment, I'm trying to do more outreach to booktubers, reviewers, influencers. Like when I started in 2016, essentially, that was like a no-go. Like, you, as an indie author, you were just, the door was shut in your face the minute you emailed in. The landscape has changed a lot, and I didn't really appreciate how much it had changed until even like last year. It was about last year when I really noticed that, no, actually, a lot of these folks are much more willing to read indie, even champion it to some extent. That's a complete change. That's a complete sea change, because trust me, when we started, that was not the case. The landscape has completely changed. So I've tried to get back into that game a bit more, which is a long game. They've got a lot. They've got very heavy schedules, these guys.
Yeah.
So if you're fortunate enough and they accept your book, just be patient. You know, they'll get to it at some point. It's not going to be when you want it to be. That's okay. Just hope that they enjoy it. And if things pay off, it's going to be a kind of long game there, as they kind of, it's, if someone likes it and they review it and it's good, someone else will think, oh, I should get to that. I remember I have that, and so on and so forth. But yeah, it's a bit of a long game. But that's where I'm trying to focus some attention there.
Nice.
Obviously, there's a bit of a craze for special editions, people jumping on Kickstarters and things like that.
Yeah.
It might already be saturated. Like, it probably will be saturated if it isn't already. But people seem to get sort of fairly steady. People seem to get a fairly steady number of backers. And certainly having those editions out there gets a lot more eyeballs on your book. So, like, people show them off, they're more likely to show them off, and then you'll be noticed more. So if you're in the position where you're able to think about doing a special edition, maybe via a Kickstarter, that can work out. That could be one way of thinking about getting some more attention on your stuff. But really, I mean, I think what I said in that marketing panel 2 years ago still applies. Like, there's no magic button. There's no magic button you can push that's like, sell more books or get more views on your book. It's just like, you've got to start at the basics of, like, first of all, is there a big audience for what you're writing? That always helps. And then, have you nailed it as best as you can? Have you worked it until your fingers are bleeding and it's like the best story you can possibly write? And then, have you got like a really amazing cover? Is the blurb really compelling? Is the title good? Because sometimes people have odd titles.
Yeah.
An odd title with an odd cover. It just, you know, it's cliche, but the packaging is so important. You've got, you know, people decide within like 6 seconds if they're going to click on it, right? Or something.
Yeah.
Or even less. Right? You've got to just give them like that sense of, ooh, that looks interesting. Ooh, that sounds good. Ooh, I'll maybe give it a go. But even then, like, as I say, for Epic Fantasy, it's like, ooh, that looks good. Ooh, that looks interesting. Ooh, I'll wait until it's finished, which is which is another battle.
Oh.
But you just start with the book. Get the book really good as you can. Get the packaging really good. Put it out there. If you've done your work there, I think, and you've put the right keywords in, and it's the correct keywords. So if you've written an Epic Fantasy and you put the right kind of keywords in and you signal the right stuff, honestly, the systems will try to sell it for you initially, but if you've mispackaged and mismarketed it in that sense, then it won't, you know, Amazon will not find the right readers. And so you've got to kind of give it that helping hand to get going. But if you're just starting and you don't have the budget, don't worry about Facebook ads. Don't worry about Amazon ads. Don't spend money you don't have. Just keep producing really good stuff. Do stuff that's a bit more free. You know, seeing if people take your ebooks to review, people understand.
Yeah.
And just do the diligent stuff in growing your socials wisely. So mailing list, always important. I really value Discord now. I think I wish I'd set a Discord server up sooner. I think it's been really great. Works really well. You get a lot of engagement. People will talk to you. People will talk to each other. They do, like, you know, spoiler discussions and all sorts of stuff. There's a group in my Discord that plays Dungeons and Dragons with each other. Nice. So it's much more of a community builder, which I think is really, really cool. So if you like Discord, if you know what that is, you can start a Discord server, and it's free, which is brilliant. And, you know, you could put a permanent link up on your website and people will trickle in. But pick the socials that work for you. If you don't like one, don't bother with it. You know, if you hate TikTok, don't use TikTok. Just stick to the ones that you like and just be good at one or two things first before you try to do everything, because, you know, don't spread yourself so thin.
Yeah. Fantastic advice.
Just keep working on putting out good books. So that was quite a lot.
That was brilliant. Thank you very much. It's been a fantastic chat, and I've always learned a lot listening to you, Michael. So thank you very much for giving up your time.
I love talking shop, so anytime at all.
What's the best place to look to learn about you and your books?
My best place, I think, is just to go to the website, which is www.michaelamello.co.uk. Everything's on there, links to all the socials, links to that aforementioned Discord server also there. Get everything from there.
There you go. Thank you very much again. It's been brilliant chatting with you, and I hope look forward to seeing you at FantasyCon later this year.
Yeah, I look forward to it. It'll be really fun.
Thanks very much for listening, everyone. A big thank you, Michael, for giving up your time, especially in the middle of book launch time. I know it's an awfully busy time for writers. So thank you very much. And I hope you enjoyed that listening at home. There's lots of fantastic insights there. And it's a fantastic example of what you can do if you manage to crack the code, and you can go it alone and forge a really successful career. So yeah, inspiration to us all. If you enjoyed this episode, do subscribe or follow the show. That way you're not going to miss any future episodes. And if you really enjoyed today's episode, a quick rating on the Spotify mobile app or a review on iTunes goes an awful long way. So thank you if you have done that. If you'd like to join our writing community, you can do so by clicking the link in the description. You can get help with beta reads. As I said before, you can get help with your opening lines, and you can just chat with fellow writers and make friends with people from all around the world. Quick reminder that our next episode will be on the 28th of October, and it's going to be a spooky one. We're going to be looking at monsters, and some of my favourite monsters as well. So I think it's a great way to end this very long run series. Like I said, we'll be back in the new year, so we won't be away for too long. So until the 28th of October, keep on scribbling.